Good evening. My name is Eric Berloff. I'm the director of the Institute of Global Affairs. And this is the last in a series of events that we've had on different global challenges, inspired by the photojournalist exhibit you might have seen in the LSE atrium in the same building here. And if you haven't seen it, please go and see it, because it is a very thought-provoking and something that I think helped us a lot in putting together these series of events. And you know, one theme that's very important in that series of photos is migration. And it's also showing the link between conflict and migration, and the link between migration and other global challenges, like pandemics and like also like climate and so on. So this is, as I said, the final event. We are very excited to do this together with the New York Times. When for us at the IGA, the migration was really the first global challenge that we addressed when we were set up in 2015. It was about trying to, you know, if you go back to 2015, of course, that was the issue that was most on the minds of Europeans, with this very massive influx of refugees from Syria. But of course, it had been a global issue for a long time, and I think the Syrian exodus also illustrated how connected these flows are throughout the world, and of course, that there was other groups of migrants that came into the same flows into Europe at the time from Afghanistan and so on. So when we set this up first, we were working very much with Peter Sutherland, who was then the special envoy of the UN Secretary General. And as you know, he passed away last year, and he was very much an inspiration for all of us. He was someone who pushed this agenda globally, and was always looking for a global solution. This cannot be addressed country by country, and that was something that was very important to him. And he created actually a number of important fora for thinking about migration, and he also changed the way, the sort of architecture of migration, in the sense that the International Organization of Migration was moved into the UN family, which I think was a major improvement in how things were managed at the global level. And of course, one thing that also came out of Peter Sutherland's thinking and work was the two compacts this year, the Global Compact on Refugees and the Global Compact on Migration. And this is going to be, we have a little bit of an experiment here now, but we're going to show you some relay a discussion that's with the two global co-facilitators of the Compact on Migration, and they will say a little bit about how this came about and what will be the next phase. They are actually meeting at this point in not so far from London, and so we will beam them in using modern technology. And after that, we'll have a discussion, we'll present two examples of how research and academic work and new innovation can influence and help address the migration challenge, really to how to manage migration. And we're very delighted to have Ivo Strasser here from the New York Times. He's the in charge of the international op-ed piece, op-ed page, and has worked before as an editor of foreign policy, and very importantly, he's LSE alumnus. And so, welcome back to your alma mater.
I am really excited to have both Mariana and Dominic here talking tonight, because they're looking at actual real innovative ways of addressing the migration issue without, I think, falling into the the broader political conversation that's not always so productive. And so, I mean, that's what I'm really I'm pleased with, and that's why I'm excited to introduce them both. And first, I think Mariana is going to give us a short presentation. Mariana Dahan is the founder and CEO of the World Identity Network. She's also a former official at the World Bank and the initiator of the Identification for Development agenda there. That was at the World Bank, right? Right. And she's also a founding member of the Global Blockchain Business Council and the blockchain program fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington. And she also put together a report that I believe you can find in this room tonight, and she's going to tell us a little bit about that. And I think, like I said, it's really important stuff, and I think policymakers should be paying attention to it. You know, part of me wonders if Angela Merkel in 2015 had been in this room and heard Mariana and Dominic sort of talk a little bit about the stuff they're working on, if some recent elections might have gone differently. Anyway, without any more from me, let's hear from Mariana.
So thank you for having me again here, and it's a real pleasure to be here in front of you and talk about identity. So you may wonder why identity in the context of migration, but it seems such a critical issue to be tackled when we hear how many migrants and refugees are moving across the globe between regions, between continents, without a way of being able to prove who they are, right? So identity in today's world is really the cornerstone of our human evolution and our interactions in the modern economy. In order for us to participate fully in today's world economy and digital world, what is critical is to have a way of proving who you are. And this is something that not so many people are able to do. In fact, you'd be surprised by the numbers. Last year, we were talking about 2 billion people not having a proof of identity. And today, we talk about more than 1 billion people. So numbers are moving, partly because some countries have undertaken huge programs of giving a digital identity to their citizens. But as the numbers of refugees and migrants are rising, we may see these numbers change again. So really, identity has become not only a social issue, but also a political issue. Being able to say who is actually entering your country space and who is there has become actually a linchpin in all these political debates today. And just some examples from the United States are really pointing to this issue. But on the global scale, I think what we can see, if only we could see, is that we have about 50 million refugees today, and 1 in 200 refugees is a child. So children today are among those mostly affected by the lack of identity and their inability of proving who they are and what are their family ties is affecting their ability to be integrated in the countries where they migrate. Migration is also affecting those children who are in their home countries, being left by the parents who went abroad in search of better lives. So how are these children carrying on with their lives? Where do they eventually end up? That's a question that I have asked myself personally. When I was at the World Bank, when I was managing this big program, which was called Identification for Development, I wanted to focus on those who were left behind. And I'm speaking from personal experience as someone who is born in the poorest country in Europe, one of the source countries of victims of human trafficking, one of the source countries of migration to Europe. You probably guessed by now you are at LSE, so you probably have the data. It is Moldova. And I decided to start World Identity Network to really address this issue and look at the opportunities that are there and the technologies that are there to confer IDs to these children and minors who have no way of proving who they are, but then also leveraging the blockchain technology, which many of you probably know what this is, to catch the human traffickers. And it is a pilot that we started with the government of Moldova and several United Nations agencies who were interested in leveraging the potential of this technology. I'm talking a little bit more about this in a TED Talk that I have recently given, but it is also illustrated in the report that you are having here. And what I wanted to highlight is the importance of the academic research and the inputs that we have received in the design phase of this pilot. And the fact that LSE has contributed to the report and has informed the policy making and the decisions that United Nations took with respect to this project were really critical. So I think this is something that needs to be encouraged as we move forward with the implementation of the UN Global Compact. What is critical for us today in the implementation phase, I believe, is to include those who have been previously excluded from this dialogue, especially if it affects them. So in the case of the migrants who are coming to Europe or even to other countries in search of a better life, I think we need to include them into the process of identifying them. Just starting by asking the question, do they want to be identified? This is something that, in the ivory towers in Washington or New York, we don't necessarily think of do the migrants and refugees want to be part of this? And while designing these global programs, how are we making sure that their voices are being heard? So this is something when we started to do this report was brought to me by a professor at LSE who was in the refugee camps and who gave me this data, which was very surprising and which we included in the report that you are having in your hands today. And the topic of human trafficking may be like a very specific use case, but I think it really illustrates the complexity we are dealing with in the context of migration. So a lot of people being caught in modern slavery rings and in human trafficking, in sex trafficking in particular, don't want their identities to be revealed yet. In order to help them, we need to be able to identify them. So this is something that is very difficult to approach. Also, in the light of the new regulation, which many of you may know, called GDPR laws that have been promulgated by the European Commission, what are the privacy-preserving mechanisms that we have in place today which would allow us to identify a victim of human trafficking without revealing her identity, but also being able to come and rescue if she was trafficked, and at the same time comply with the right to be forgotten of the trafficker himself, who has, as a human being, the right to privacy? I think these are all such interesting questions, but also very complex, and something that we need the best minds out there to help understand. And that's why I want to highlight again the importance of bringing the academics to the table, and also the media. I think today we've learned a lot from the investigative journalists who were working on the front lines and bringing to us those pieces of information that were missing in this dialogue and these high-level discussions at the UN and the World Bank. And this is something that I have learned firsthand. So, again, this report brings together those perspectives, and it's a true collaboration that it's not that common today to bring civil society, academia, United Nations, private sector to think through these complex problems that we are facing today in the context of migration. I also want to talk about an initiative led by the refugees himself. Themselves, right? So, and this is the story of Tayel Jula, and it is illustrated on our website, among other stories of people who are actually not only the problem carriers, but also the solution providers. So those people who have been in these refugee camps, who had their identities lost, but then started companies and initiatives leveraging the newest technologies, the blockchain technology in this case, to register births occurring in the refugee camps as we speak, and basically providing a chance to these children to thrive in today's society because they know how important this is. They've lived through this firsthand. So they are also those who would be better informed, perhaps even more than UN officials or World Bank officials. So really happy to be supporting this as part of our work at the World Identity Network. This work and these initiatives that are being undertaken by refugees themselves and people who lived through these experiences themselves. Another thing that I've learned through a partnership with another non-governmental organization, actually based out of the UK, the Hopes and Homes for Children, something that I learned in the context of human trafficking and modern slavery is that the orphanage system is a channel, it's an engine for providing victims of human trafficking. And I had absolutely no idea about that. And this after more than 10 years spent at the World Bank and doing this type of work, it is only when I, as I said, I went to meet with people who are actually doing this work on the ground that I learned so much. And in the case of the 8 million children who live in the orphanage today, in the orphanages today, more than 80% of them actually have families, but the orphanages are actually a charity-based system that draws in funding. So as such, is a business that, in a sense, instrumentalizes the children. And then it is through these channels that a lot of the human trafficking and modern slavery occurs, because once you lose touch and lose track of a child who is out of a family, it's actually much easier to have this child exploited and used. In Moldova, for instance, children without identities, without any way of proving who they are, and the ones who are being lost in these systems are being used for organ trade, for organ sale in Europe and elsewhere. So it's really tragic that we don't understand these things when we are not in touch with these organizations. So as part of my work today, I like to bring together the brightest minds to think through complex problems like this in the context of migration, but not only the usual suspects, not only the UN agencies, the World Bank, and the superpowers of this world, but actually the problem carriers, the ones who are living through these situations every day. I think they will be key to implementing these compacts and these policies that are being designed. Involving them in the process of design and implementation would be key. So this is on my side. I don't have much time to speak, but the report is out there. Again, thank you very much to LSE and to New York Times for co-hosting the event, but to LSE in particular for inviting me and for providing this report to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariana. That was fascinating, and I'm sure people will have a lot of follow-up questions, and we'll have an interesting discussion later. But next, Dominic Hungartner is going to. How'd I do? Good. is going to present some of his research. Dominic is a professor, associate professor of public policy at ETH Zurich, and is also at the LSE. He's also the co-director of the Stanford Zurich Immigration Policy Lab. After pre-doctoral fellowships at Harvard, Washington University in St. Louis, and UC Berkeley, he received his PhD in social science from the University of Bern in 2011, and in the same year he joined the LSE. His research combines fieldwork and statistics to study the effects of migration policy, and that's exactly what he's going to be talking about this evening. And he's been published in a variety of leading scholarly journals, including the American Journal of Political Science, American Political Science Review, and Science, where I believe some of this research first appeared. And it's fascinating, and I think everyone's going to get a lot out of it. So,
thank you so much for the kind introduction. I would love to talk a little bit about a very simple idea that we at the Immigration Policy Lab have been started to trial and implement in two countries. And it tries to tackle one of the big fundamental challenges that many refugee-receiving countries across the globe are facing, and that is the economic but also social integration of refugees. Obviously, what I will present, that's only at best a partial solution, but it's a very cost-effective and efficient solution, and so I look forward to your feedback. The starting point for this was based on a lot of research that we at the Immigration Policy Lab, but also other researchers focused on immigration have been doing, which basically tries to assist national programs in the reception, placement, and assistance of refugees in their integration and achieving economic self-sufficiency and success in host societies. And we've done a lot of work on what policies are effective and cost-efficient in facilitating that successful integration. And there are a few things which always pop up. For example, shorter asylum processes, because lengthy asylum processes have a really detrimental long-term consequences for the economic but also social integration of refugees. These extended lives on hold are really eroding motivation and the ability of people to integrate in the host society once they learn that they can stay. Similarly, longer employment bans that exist in many European countries also have not only contemporary but also long-term consequences, and so fast labor market access is also essential to the successful integration of refugees, as is early enrollment in intensive and certified language courses, as we've seen in Germany, for example. And so together, this research suggests something like the idea of an integration window, that is, all the policies that are effective in facilitating the integration of refugees are disproportionately effective if they are targeted towards the early period after arrival, so the first few months or the first year within arrival. That everything that works right in that time period has long-term, disproportionately long-term positive effect. And so based on this, we came up with a new and innovative approach to help with that early integration. That is the